Matthew 9:10-17. And it came to pass, as Jesus sat at meat in the house, behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto his disciples, Why eateth your master with publicans and sinners? But when Jesus heard that, he said unto them, They that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. But go ye and learn what that meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice. For I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Then came to him the disciples of John, saying, Why do we and the Pharisees fast oft, but thy disciples fast not? And Jesus said unto them, Can the children of the bride chamber mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken from them, and then shall they fast. No man putteth a piece of new cloth unto an old garment, for that which is put in to fill it up taketh from the garment, and the rent is made worse. Neither do men put new wine into old bottles, else the bottles break, and the wine runneth out, and the bottles perish. And they put new wine into new bottles, and both are preserved.
So this morning we're going to look at Christ's parable about new cloth on an old garment. And as sometimes happens, right before I came up here, I lost my voice, so.
I didn't see that. You got 2 miles.
Well, I ate something very sugary, and I think it affected me. So, Jackson has read for us the Matthew 9 portion of this. It actually appears 3 times. In Scripture, in the New Testament, of course. It appears in Matthew 9, as we read, Mark 2, verses 21 and 22. And it also appears in Luke 5, verses 36 through 38. But for purposes of this morning, we're just going to look at Matthew. All three appearances, they're very, very close. Some slight differences in them. One of the differences is you see in verse 9 of the Matthew account, he's named the man sitting at the seat of custom is named Matthew, and in the others, he's named Levi. So it's small variances like that. So this opens on a scene where Jesus is sitting down to a meal at a house after he's called Matthew, who he passed at the receipt of custom, and said, follow me, and Matthew simply got up and followed Christ. Clearly he knew who he was. But it's not clear in verse 10 exactly whose house it was, whether it's Matthew's house or someone else's house. I'm not sure it particularly matters. Other than the scene that unfolds after that. So, Jesus is sitting to eat at the house. There are many publicans, many sinners, and Jesus and, of course, his disciples are there as well. So it's quite a crowd is assembled there. It's not a few. It says specifically, many publicans and sinners. So it probably was a fairly good-sized house. If not, it was very, very crowded. I thought it would be helpful to look at who the players are in here. We have publicans and sinners, as I said, but then we also have the Pharisees. And how do these people, what kind of roles do they play? What type of people are they? So the publicans, were the tax collectors, like Zacchaeus in Luke 19. The Easton's Bible Dictionary refers to them as those who farmed the taxes. So they were the tax collectors. They levied the taxes in a town or in a district, and undertook to pay the supreme government a certain amount. So it wasn't like what we have today where There are taxes on income. The government wanted a certain amount out of that town or that province. And people like Zacchaeus would then go about collecting that amount within the town. In New Testament times, these taxes were paid to the Romans, of course, and hence were regarded by the Jews as a very heavy burden on them. So, needless to say, the taxes and the collectors of taxes, who were frequently Jews at this time, were not held in very high regard. They weren't liked very much, and were usually spoken of in very strong disapproval by everybody. They weren't popular at all. So Jesus, being accused of being a friend of publicans and sinners, was, of course, not a compliment to Jesus, at least by the people that were calling him that. So we also have the Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees were a group of especially observant and also influential Jews. They were around from the 2nd century B.C. to the 1st century A.D. But the name, how that name came about, is not really clear. In Hebrew, it might mean separate ones, which referred to their observance of ritual purity and also tithing. It could also mean the interpreters, referring to their unique interpretations of biblical law. We can look at what Josephus said about them. And he referred to the Pharisees as a group of people who have made a choice of life and had a certain philosophy. Josephus says that the Pharisees were the group most influential with the people. The Pharisees were noted for their accurate and authoritative interpretations of Jewish law. And the Pharisees also had their own traditions and a way of life to which they were faithful. So they appeared to be set apart from the larger body. The Pharisees had a simple standard of living and cultivated harmonious relations with others, he says. And the Pharisees also believed that the soul survives death and is punished or rewarded with another life, similar to what some Christian religions today believe. In addition to their religious inclinations, some Pharisees incited opposition to the government, although some of the Pharisees worked with the chief priests to keep order in times of trouble. And Josephus says right around the first century that the number of Pharisees was about 6,000. He doesn't describe how one joined the group or what was required, you know, as far as membership or to stay in it. And he speculates that it may have been like a Hellenistic school which taught a specific way of life, or political or social faction competing for recognition and power within Judaism. Or it simply could have been a sect that wanted to separate itself from a larger body of people. The Pharisees went through different incarnations over time, displaying various tendencies. So over the 200 years of their existence, they exercised diverse roles within society. So now we have an understanding of who the players are in the scene. Looking at verse 10 again, Jesus is sitting down at meat with the publicans and the sinners and his disciples. And the Pharisees appear. Whether they were simply observing this meal or they were partaking in it, it's not clear. But they ask Christ's disciples, "Why eateth your master with publicans and sinners?" The words there don't make it clear whether the Pharisees were simply inquiring why. It certainly could be interpreted that way. They just wanted to know why Christ was sitting down with those people. But reading this description that I found of the Pharisees, it's more likely they were not pleased. They would look at publicans and sinners as very undesirable people. And that was a further knock against Christ for associating with them. We saw this morning in our second reading, before our exhortation, if you want to turn to John 12, let's see where it is. That people that were the leaders of the community would not confess Christ's name. I can't find it exactly here. Which one? 42, next page. That they wouldn't confess Christ's name because the Pharisees. The Pharisees, they were afraid, would drive them out of the synagogue. For they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. So I think the Pharisees certainly looked down upon the people that Christ was associating with. And, of course, they looked down on Christ himself because he was critical of them. And he was a threat to their situation. So the Pharisees ask Christ's disciples why Christ is eating with publicans and sinners. But Christ actually hears them. He hears them talking to his disciples, and the disciples don't respond. Christ actually responds, saying, "They that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick." So he turns it right around on them. They're asking why would Christ associate with these undesirable people. Christ turns it around and points out that he's there acting as a physician. A physician would seek out those that are sick, not those that felt that they were not in need of a physician. Those that felt that they were healthy, like the Pharisees, of course, they felt that they had no need of something like that. Christ then admonishes them, telling them to go, and ye learn what that meaneth. So go away, think about what I've said. Think about what you're doing. Think about what you should be doing. And consider your words, your thoughts, your deeds. Consider them in light of what God has laid out for you and the principles of the law, not the jots and the tittles of the law that the Pharisees seem to be so well-versed in. Think about it in the principles of the law that God has laid out for us. And consider yourself in that context. Christ then goes on to say, "For I am not come to call the righteous, but the sinners to repentance." So who is righteous here? Now, the Pharisees may have thought that they were righteous. We know from our studies that there's a small group of people who are righteous. God, angels. We know that we can do things that God may consider to be righteous, but we also know that the next moment we could turn around and do something that would make God very angry. That's absolutely not righteous. That's sinful. So Christ has not come to call the righteous, but the sinners. We, of course, are all sinners. That's the nature that we're born with. These men that he was speaking to, whether they knew it or not, they were sinners. They may have thought of themselves as quite righteous and above not only the people that Christ was associating with, but they may have felt that they were above Christ and really anybody else. They were very powerful. They were leaders in the community. They were in control of the synagogue. So while Christ was actually talking directly to them, they probably had no idea. We then see in verse 14, then came to him, the disciples of John, asking, why do we and the Pharisees fast often, but thy disciples, and I guess Christ, do not? So why is that? Well, Christ explains to them in what may have not been a clear way to them. In verse 15, Jesus said unto them, the children of the bride chamber mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them. So what does that mean? Well, it's, he's talking about a marriage and the bridegroom, and that's a time of joy, that's a time of celebration. It's not a time for mourning. Why would they mourn while he's with them? It's a feast. It's a happy time. He then goes on to say, but the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken from them, and then shall they fast. So at that point, then they would mourn when the bridegroom is gone. We, of course, know that Christ is referring to himself and the body of saints, Christ being the bridegroom. So he was telling them at that point that they should be happy that he's there. They should take advantage of his presence, to rejoice that he's there for them to interact directly with and take advantage of his knowledge and what he had to teach them. Because when he was gone, at the soon coming time that he would be gone, that was then the time for them to mourn and to fast. And what's fasting? Well, our bodies have a built-in system that tells us when we need nourishment. And fasting is a denial of that. It's a symbol of self-control, exercising that self-control over what our physical and natural needs are. It's our intellectual way of overcoming that. And we are expected when we're fasting that way, or when these people were fasting at this time, that they would be, why are they doing it? Well, they're considering, they're in a state of mourning, and they're considering what they're doing. They're denying themselves something as a way to contemplate what they've been given and the blessings that they have. Looking at, finally, we reach verse 16, which says, no man putteth a piece of new cloth onto an old garment, for that which is put in to fill it up taketh away from the garment, and the rent or the rip is made worse. So let's look at that. You have an old garment. What is an old garment? Well, it's worn. When it was new, fiber. It had just been created. The fibers were they were woven together. They were very strong. It was of a certain thickness. Over time, that garment, maybe it gets frayed around the edges. It gets worn in certain spots from overuse. The fibers aren't quite as tight as they used to be. They've relaxed a little bit. They're looser. The garment itself is a little bit weaker, certainly not the way it was when it was brand new. Our natural inclination, if the garment finally reached a point where something happened, maybe it was mistreated in some way, and it ripped. There's a small rip in it, perhaps. We might want to go and get a new piece of cloth and cover that up to repair the garment or to create the illusion that it's been repaired, to protect it from any further damage, to cover it over so that people don't see that it's ripped. This, I think, is a great metaphor for our lives in our walk in the truth, or for anybody who's trying to follow God's instruction. Over time, your garment, your life, you're going to do inevitably, because it's our nature, we're going to do things that create these little rips, create these flaws. Our garment will become warm. If we try and cover it up, as is illustrated here by Christ, what happens is that newer cloth that is quite a bit stronger than what it's trying to repair, it will be adhered to it in some fashion, and then as time goes on, you've got that stronger piece of cloth on that weaker one. As it's stressed in some fashion, as it's pulled at, eventually, that stronger area, it's likely it's just going to rip it more. It'll appear to have repaired it for a short time, but the chances are, eventually, it's going to stress that old garment more. And as Christ says, the rent is made worse. So let's look at that. Let's look at that specifically as far as our walk in the truth and the garment that we're wearing during that time and what we're all hoping for. Let's turn over to Revelation 3. Revelation 3 and verse 5, which says, "He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment," which is his garment. Christ says, "I will not blot out his name out of the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." So what is Christ telling us? He's talking about he that overcometh. So those people that have overcome what? They've overcome the natural tendencies of these fleshly vessels that we inhabit. What is overcoming? It's working day by day, week by week, to resist our natural inclinations to do things that would be displeasing to our Creator. So those are the people that he's talking about those that have done that, we all sin at various times, and one part of overcoming is asking for forgiveness for those transgressions. So Christ is talking about the people that have done all of those things. They're not entirely sinless. They have sin, but they've asked for forgiveness. Christ says, the same, those people shall be clothed in white raiment. They'll receive a brand new garment, let's say. So this scene sounds very much like the judgment seat, doesn't it? Somebody that's overcome, they'll be clothed in white raiment, so they'll be given immortal life. And Christ says, I will not blot out his name out of the book of life. So that person's name, and hopefully that'll be everybody in the room here, it's what we all hope to be, will be counted among those who Christ will not take our names out of that book of life, but will be counted among those in the book of life who Christ will confess their names before his Father, Yahweh, and before God's angels. So there we are, hope to be wearing a new garment in that situation. We can also see another appearance in Revelation 7. If you'd like to turn to that. And, excuse me. Let's look at verse 13 and verse 14, which says, And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, What are these which are arrayed in white robes? Here we have the white robes again. And whence came they? And I said unto him, Sir, thou knowest. And he said to me, These are they which came out of great tribulation. Which if you look at the Greek word, it's pressure. Great tribulation. Well, what kind of tribulation? We can look at what's going on around us today and we can envision the tribulation that they're talking about here. Perhaps there are some of the people that we hear about who over in the Middle East are being killed because they follow Christ. But these people have come out of great tribulation. They've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And as we know, only Christ's blood can truly wash away our transgressions. So we can turn back to Matthew 9 here. So we can see here what I think Christ was referring to in 16 and 17 when he was talking about this new cloth into an old garment, and there's not an absolutely clear tie to what he had said before. I think he's referring to this idea that putting new cloth on this garment that we're wearing, it's not ever going to hide our flaws. It won't hide those rips that occur as we make our way through life and try as we might to follow the instruction of God and to follow the example of Christ. We will develop rips. We have flaws. And if we try and cover them up, it may be a way of denying that they exist. We need to acknowledge that those flaws exist, and seek for that new garment. To do our best to atone for that. Because I think trying to hide those flaws, trying to cover them up with something, so that nobody sees them, well, we know they're there. God knows they're there. Christ knows they're there. Everybody knows that they're there. The flaw is still there. It creates within us maybe a false sense of atonement, like we're hiding them. We're not. So let's finally look at 17, which is reinforcement of verse 16. It says, Neither do men put new wine into old bottles, else the bottles break, and the wine runneth out, and the bottles perish. But they put new wine into new bottles, and both are preserved. If you go look at Young's literal, it actually substitutes the word bottles for skins. So, and that's what they used at this time, is not bottles, but skins. And it's the same idea as the garment. The wine is put in there. Even after it's fermented, it continues to emit an amount of CO2. So as the wine is in this skin, this bag, there's some expansion that occurs. And as you can imagine, the skin is stretched. It's as the wine continues to age, and as that gas collects in the skin. So were someone to then try and reuse that, put new wine in there, of course it would burst. It would break because it's no longer strong enough to support that new wine, to support that process that's happening. So that's all I have. Any questions or comments? Mm-hmm.